Next up, we're going to talk about Universal, A Guide to the Cosmos. Brian Cox back on Coast to Coast after almost 16 years. He's next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. George Norrie with you. Brian Cox, Professor of Particle Physics at the University of Manchester and the Royal Society Professor for Public Engagement in Science, also works at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva. And you can also see him on his highly acclaimed BBC television documentaries, including Human Universe and The Forces of Nature, his new book, Universal, A Guide to the Cosmos. Brian, welcome back to the program. It's been like 100 years almost.
Yeah, you said it's 16 years. Is that really right?
Yeah, you were last on, according to my records, August 5th of 2001. Unbelievable.
Wow.
Long time. Yeah. How have you been?
Well, good to be back. I've been kind of busy.
Just a little bit.
As you said, last time I was on, we were still building the Large Hadron Collider. So that's a long time ago. I mean, of course, famously discovered the Higgs particle, which was interesting, actually. My most cited academic paper is on physics without a Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider.
How long is that collider?
It's 16 miles in circumference. So it's under two countries. Most of it's underneath France, but a part of it is underneath Switzerland.
That's a long, long collider. And it costs billions of dollars. But are we getting, do you think we're getting our money's worth for it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's an interesting question, actually. There's a simple answer, which is it was constructed to either confirm or break our fundamental theory of subatomic particles. It's called the Standard Model of Particle Physics. And that's the theory that tells us how all the forces of nature, other than gravity, work, and how those forces interact with the building blocks of nature. So it's a very important piece of our understanding of the natural world. And we got to the point where there was a direct prediction from that model, which was that there was this particle called the Higgs particle, which is responsible for giving things mass in the universe at the most fundamental level. And we needed to check. We needed to see whether that theory was correct or whether it was wrong and something else was happening. And so the LHC was really constructed to do that initially, and it's shown that the theory is correct, which is a quite remarkable thing. So the next step now is to fully understand that mechanism. The theory never spelled out in absolute detail how that works, but it did predict the existence of this particle called the Higgs particle, and that's what we discovered. It's a remarkable prediction, actually, if you think about it. I mean, essentially a mathematical prediction, which has its roots back in the 1960s, but actually, really before that, really you're talking of about most of 20th century physics goes into a prediction of a new fundamental thing in nature, which is this thing called the Higgs field or the Higgs particle. And it's essentially the statement that the universe is not empty. Empty space is not empty. It is filled with something, which is known as the Higgs field. And the particles out of which we are made, let's say the electrons in our bodies, are interacting with that stuff, that field, and in doing so, acquiring mass or substance. So it's a rather esoteric sounding thing. You might say, well, how on earth could we go about predicting such a thing? That's one of the great triumphs of science. There's a very famous essay by the physicist Eugene Wigner called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics in the Physical Sciences. And this is a very good example of that. It almost feels unreasonable that you can predict things about reality, about the real world, by making deductions using mathematics based on observations that we've made in the past. But the Higgs is a beautiful example of that.
I remember, Brian, when Large Hadron Collider was going online, everybody thought it was going to create black holes and wormholes and suck the planet in.
Well, the use of the term "everybody" is the error there. A few people in their basements who've not yet moved out of their parents' house.
Yes.
And then, you know, it's one of the great problems, as we know at the moment, actually. It's one of the things we wrote the book for, one of the reasons we wrote the book. One of the great problems is how you check, how are we to weigh statements that are made and that may be widely propagated on the internet or in the media? You know, what do we actually know about the natural world, and what is, you know, essentially emanating, as I said, from a few people sat in their basements with a computer? And it can be difficult because the availability of a story, or the visibility of a story, or even the fame of the people that propagate stories, is no guide to whether there is any sense in the story at all. And so our book, although we're dealing towards the end of the book with modern cosmology, which is extremely counterintuitive. You know, we're talking about with some, not certainty, we're never certain in science, but with some authority about things that happened in the first moments after the Big Bang, and even, as we'll discuss later, I suppose, in some sense, what happened before the Big Bang, if you define the Big Bang carefully.
Oh.
So how can we have confidence in that? I mean, it seems very far removed from common sense or from everyday reality. It's the same with the black hole thing. Yeah, how is an average person who maybe is not particularly interested in science or has no time to go and read academic papers, how is that person to make a judgment if they see a ridiculous story about a particle collider destroying the world? I mean, I should say, the energy in these particle collisions, you can describe it in two ways. One is you can say that in the collisions we recreate the conditions that were present less than a billionth of a second after the Big Bang. Now that sounds scary in some sense. However, we recreate them in a very small region of space, and the actual energy of the particles colliding in the Large Hadron Collider is equivalent to a mosquito hitting you in the face. So that's not going to do much damage to your face, never mind the world. So, you know, these are challenging questions that certainly go beyond science, which is about trust and about how we are to understand and weigh different statements.
Well, you brought up something that I was going to ask you anyways, Brian, and that has to do with this so-called Big Bang. I also want to talk with you about some people talking about a holographic universe, that this isn't, that we're not real. But the Big Bang, I personally have a very difficult time understanding how something may have started before anything did. I mean, how something started from nothing. I just don't get it.
Well, the observation, the basic observation, which was debated widely in the 1950s and really didn't come into sort of wide acceptance until the 60s, the observation is that if you look out into the universe, so let's say we look at the most distant object you can see with the naked eye, which is the Andromeda Galaxy.
Okay.
So you can see that on a dark night. It's just over 2 million light years away, which means you're seeing it as it was 2 million years in the past, because the light has taken 2 million years to travel that distance to your eye. So you can see that. So as you look further out into the universe, you look further back in time. And the question was, back in the 1940s and 50s, has the universe always been the same? Or if you look sufficiently far away, so you look sufficiently far back in time, does it look different? Has it changed over that time? And what we find is that, yes, it was different. About 13.8 billion years ago or so, it was extremely hot and extremely dense. And so there were no galaxies and no stars. There was just a boiling hot plasma of matter, which is almost like the interior of a star. You could almost think of it like that. So the whole universe was like that. And that's the basic observation. So it's something you can see. And I mentioned the 1960s. In the 1960s, the glow of that hot plasma was seen for the first time. It's got a name. It's called the Cosmic Microwave Background Radiation. But the Nobel Prize was given to two American engineers and physicists, actually, Penzias and Wilson, for detecting that. So that's the basic observation. So once upon a time, the universe was not like this, with stars and galaxies. It was very hot and very dense. And that's essentially, initially, what we refer to as the Big Bang. And we can measure the time back to that.
How did it start, though, Brian?
Well, so then you start asking questions about how did it get hot and dense? We know when it was hot and dense, and we know that it was. So how did it get there? And the answer is that we don't know the honest answer at the moment. When you make an observation in science, then the other side of the coin, as it were, is a model, a theoretical model that allows you to interpret what you see and try to make sense of it. And that model is Einstein's theory of general relativity, Einstein's theory of gravity, which is 101 years old, actually, this year. So that model breaks down when you go to sufficiently high temperatures. So it doesn't work properly. We need a better theory, and we don't have one at the moment. So that the proper answer is that we don't know what happened at the start. However, we do have some ideas, and one of the ideas is one of the key points in our book, actually, Universal, which is a theory called inflation. And it's quite simple to state, actually. So the idea is, before the universe was hot and dense, it was still there, but it was doing something else. It was in a different state, if you like. And the idea is that it was expanding extremely rapidly, and that's why it's called inflation. And the basic model is that comes to an end, and in doing so, all the energy that was driving that very fast expansion gets dumped into space, it heats it up, it makes particles, and that's what we now call that the hot Big Bang, to differentiate it from the Big Bang, which you might say is the origin of everything, and about which we know very little. So then the interesting question becomes, well, how long was the universe doing that other thing, that inflation?
Exactly.
And we don't know. We don't have a measurement. We have a minimum time, which is a tiny fraction of a second, actually. But we really don't know. That's the edge of our understanding and the edge of our observation. I should say just very briefly that we have good evidence, which we describe in the book, that theory of inflation is not crazy. We have observational evidence that it may well be on the right track. And one of the key, most beautiful predictions is the theory predicts how the galaxies should be distributed through the universe. So we can see that. We've made measurements. We can map the positions of galaxies, hundreds of millions of them, which we've done with a big project called the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And when you look at that, you find that there's a bit of a pattern in the galaxies. It's not completely random. And that pattern was a prediction before the measurement was made from the theory of inflation that says that before the hot Big Bang, the universe was still in existence. But so I think it's one of the most remarkable predictions in modern science. And in the book, we describe how that prediction was made. And try also to say, well, then how much confidence should you have in it? I mean, it predicts some things you can measure, like you can measure the distribution of galaxies. You know, you can see them. And so, but that's, I think, the key thing. There's two strands to the book. One is, as I say, to describe these remarkable things that we're saying about the universe, the understanding we have of the way the universe looks today, how it got to be this way. But also, always bearing in mind that we're not trying to say to the reader, you have to take this on our word. Right? Science is the antithesis of that. So it's not that scientists are priests passing down knowledge to the people below who sort of gratefully accept it and believe it. So science is a process by which you try to understand nature. And we always, even though we get so esoteric at the end of the book, we're always trying to say, and this is why we may say this, and this is the amount of doubt you might have in these statements.
Do we bring in the God factor at all, Brian? As a scientist, do you even consider that?
No, I don't personally, and this is a personal thing. I don't think it's productive or useful to say, well, no scientist believes in God, and it's demonstrably not true, actually. Some do. And I honestly, personally, don't think about it very much. I was brought up in a very loosely Church of England background. So really, you know, didn't really go to church very much or any of those things. So it never really crossed my mind, and it still doesn't. I'm perfectly comfortable with people who have faith, and I'm perfectly comfortable with people who don't. I don't think about it. I have a good friend, actually, who's the dean of a cathedral in Britain. So he's kind of, you know, quite a religious man. And we go out for dinner, and we talk about physics and talk about science and talk about theology as well. But I tend to be quite interested in a historical sense in the different religions as ways of reacting to the world that we see. But I put no more weight on it than that. Then that's the honest answer.
We're with Professor Brian Cox here at Coast to Coast, talking about his work, Universal, A Guide to the Cosmos, here on Coast to Coast. What about the holographic universe? People like Elon Musk are beginning to think we live in a digital world that might have been created.
Yeah, there are different. The holographic universe is kind of a technical statement about different mathematical models and their correspondence with each other. But what you refer to with Elon Musk is the idea that we might live in a computer simulation, which is actually, it's worth exploring that. It's kind of, in some ways, an in-principle argument. So we already, as a civilization, we've had computers for less than 100 years, significantly less, actually, let's say 50 years, really. And in that time, we've been able to build simulations of the universe. Now they are extremely coarse, but they're what I referred to earlier, actually. We can start the universe off actually before the Big Bang in our simulations, and we do some of that in the book. And we can carry it through to the formation of galaxies, and we can see galaxies form, and we can see structures in the way the clusters of galaxies are formed. So that's a simulation of the universe. Now, can you imagine that if you give us another 1,000 years, or 10,000 years, or 1,000,000 years of technological development, can you imagine simulations of such fidelity that you could simulate essentially conscious beings in those simulations? Now, if you think that consciousness, and we have no reason to think otherwise, if you think consciousness is a property of nature, it's a process that in principle you could simulate, you simulate the way all the atoms in your brain move and work and interact, let's say, then there seems no reason why those conscious beings in the simulation would know that they were in a simulation. And so then the question arises, well, then are we in such a simulation? Could you observe something that would let you know that? And as you say, there are some rather speculative suggestions.
Yes.
that nature might look like that it might at some level be digitized. You know, it might be that there are basic units of information in the universe. And that I should emphasize, this is all extremely speculative, but the nice thing about these ideas is that, and it teaches you again about how to do science, which is why I quite like them, is that you have to say, well, if you object to it, why do you object? Is it just some visceral objection? Is this design not a simulation? Is that all you're saying? Or are you unpicking it, saying, well, what reason could we have for refuting this idea? And it is very hard to refute the idea that we could be essentially things in a computer program. And so I emphasize to your listeners, I'm not saying that that's the case. I don't think we have any evidence one way or the other at the moment, other than the reasonably, well, the not ridiculous argument that in principle, I can't see a reason why we wouldn't, given another, let's say, 1,000,000 years of technological progress, why we wouldn't be able to build simulations of very high fidelity.
Hold on for a second, Brian. We're at this break. We're going to come back for more. Brian Cox with us right here as we talk about Universal, A Guide to the Cosmos. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, along with Brian Cox, as we talk about the cosmos, one of our favorite subjects here. Brian, back to this digital holographic type world that we may or may not be living in. The concepts are just amazing, just by being able to concentrate on just so many possibilities. And maybe there's no right, maybe there's no wrong. What do you think?
No, I think that nature is out there. It is a construct beyond us. We are part of it, I should say. And what we try and do is understand it. And science is a very humble pursuit in that sense. Really, what we're doing is building models of nature. And over the centuries, it's become clear that mathematics is a good language to build those models. And we test them, and we try and understand more about the natural world of which we are a part and in which we live. And that's it, really. So, whether or not, how closely our models approach reality is a good question. And I'm not sure. One of my great heroes, Richard Feynman, one of the great physicists mm-hmm. of the 20th century, once said, you know, am I interested in learning the absolute truth about nature, the great theory of everything? No, I'm not. I'm just interested in understanding the world I see a little bit better. And I think it's a good thing to bear in mind when you're listening to scientists, that's primarily what they're interested in. The good ones, anyway, I would say, are just interested in understanding things a bit better. And a lot of this investigation comes from asking very simple questions. I'm just starting a tour, actually, which a sort of speaking tour, which I hope to bring to the U.S. at some point.
Oh, great. When you do, look us up, would you? Please.
Yeah, I certainly will. I mean, I've been in Australia, and I'm going to be in the U.K. again next month, and Europe. And one of the things I'm thinking about, talking about in my next talks is rainbows. Rainbows are fascinating things. They obviously demand an explanation when you think about it. So you look at them and they're so like, why are they that big arc across the sky? Why are the colors the way they are? And you can go back over 1,000 years and see some of the great early scientists and philosophers trying to understand rainbows. And ultimately, it drove a lot of work into the nature of light itself, which in the hands of people in the of 19th century really led to our understanding of electricity and magnetism and helped us understand that, which led to the invention of the electric motor by Michael Faraday and the generator, and then ultimately to quantum mechanics, which led to the invention of the transistor and really modern civilization. Right? One of the paths you can follow through the knowledge, the generation of knowledge we needed to build this civilization we take for granted, is just trying to understand very simple things like, for example, rainbows. And this is a key point about science. It's not all, or even mostly, actually, about philosophy and about grand questions. Most of it turns out to be about understanding nature, which then turns out to be useful, not surprisingly, because we live in nature. So the idea that we can understand it and begin to manipulate manipulate nature, essentially, which is what electricity is, and what this is how we're talking now, and that turns out to be useful. It's enhanced our way of life immeasurably. So I think this is important. I think that science is often portrayed, I think, as, I mean, you asked a question earlier about science and religion, about science and philosophy, and it does touch on those things, but really, yeah, it is very simple and rather humble, which is about understanding the world that we see, which I would argue very strongly, in my view, is out there. You read people who have other opinions and think that consciousness is some magical thing. And I don't think that. I think that everything we know tells us that that there's a physical reality out there of which we are a part, and understanding it is a good idea.
Brian, before we get into the possibility of the multiverse theory, I want to get back to this Big Bang again. And if you kind of paint us a visual picture, In your opinion, even though we all say we don't know, of what things looked like prior to what they call the Big Bang. Now, I know that's a lot of speculation, but what do you think was out there first?
Well, so as I mentioned earlier, the theory which I think is the most attractive at the moment, and the one we detail in the book, and it leads to multiverses, actually, in a sense, is this theory of inflation. So the idea is that space and time, so space-time, as Einstein described it, which you can almost picture as the fabric of the universe, was there, and it was stretching, and it was stretching extremely quickly. And so you have a universe without structure, just with essentially space and time are there, and the whole thing is stretching extremely fast. And quite naturally, in these models of how that might happen, and we have models of how that might happen, the thing draws to a close. So what you're picturing before the Big Bang is really a cold and empty universe that's stretching very fast, and that rate of stretch falls off, and eventually sort of almost catastrophically stops, if I could use that word. So it stops very rapidly and heats up, and you get an extremely hot, densely populated universe, ultimately made of the subatomic particles that are going to make everything that we can see in the sky and indeed ourselves. So that transition through from the very rapidly expanding empty universe into a very slowly expanding, dense and hot universe is what we picture as the hot Big Bang, which we used to call the origin of everything. But now, as I say, we're not so sure, because there seems to be this pre-existing phase, which we call inflation. Now, if I may, to go on to your next question, how does that lead into these multiverse ideas? Mm-hmm. Well, the idea is quite simple. The idea is that this rapid expansion, this inflationary expansion, doesn't all stop at once. It stops in patches. So you get patches of this pre-existing, rapidly expanding universe that kind of decay away, if you like, that stop expanding and get hot and then produce a Big Bang. The rest of it carries on, and then another patch will stop, another patch will stop, another patch will stop. And so these theories, in a sense, naturally lead to the idea that there are multiple hot Big Bangs, essentially an infinite number of them, that are happening now and have been happening for a very long time, possibly forever, although there are arguments about that. We don't know really if these theories are right, how long that process has been going on for. But essentially, you can imagine each one of these little patches that stops inflating and gets hot and makes a little Big Bang as the origin of a little bubble universe. And so then our universe becomes one of those bubbles. And so you get effectively an infinite, it's called the inflationary multiverse. So these are real places. These are places in space-time, little bubbles that are not inflating. And that's the exception rather than the rule. So these little bubbles, inside one of which we sit, are just the kind of afterthoughts in this inflationary multiverse, in a sense. So that's now this theory. One of the things it does is it allows for the laws of nature that we see to be different in each one of these bubbles. So one of the great questions, which goes back to a question you asked earlier about one of the ways you start becoming theological or philosophical, mm-hmm. is it's true that we look out on a universe that appears made for us. You know, it appears beautifully tuned for life to exist, and indeed, in a sense, it is. The laws of nature appear to have to be quite delicately balanced in order, for example, for carbon to be produced in stars. Now, a caveat is we don't know whether that statement is true. We don't know whether the laws that we see today are the only way they could be. We don't know how much freedom a creator would have if they wanted to dial the dials a little bit and change the strengths of the forces and the masses of the particles. We don't know. But it certainly looks as if we live, we're fortunate, in a sense, that we live in this beautifully balanced universe. And the answer to that in the multiverse is that all possibilities exist. So it's like tossing a coin, and if you toss a coin enough, you will, at some point, you'll get 1,000 heads, and you'll think, wow, I got 1,000 heads. Yep. There's something strange about this coin. There isn't. It's just that you toss the coin, you know, billions and billions and billions of times, and ultimately there's a probability you'll get your fortunate sequence of heads. And that, in the multiverse, that's one explanation in these multiverse theories for why our universe looks the way it does. It's because all universes exist.
Is it frustrating, Brian, to a scientist, because we really, as we go back to that beginning, don't know the real answer? Does it get to be frustrating? I'd go crazy trying to get the answer.
I mean, and some scientists have been very upset, if that's the right word, about it. I mean, I should say again, I mean, we're only in the business of understanding nature as she is, right? So you shouldn't be upset if nature turns out not to be the way that you kind of want it to be.
Right.
However, that some scientists are upset because it was always a great goal of physics, and it may still be, to say we understand why the universe is the way it is. It's a theory of everything that predicts everything, perhaps from one number that you have to put in by hand, and then you get a prediction for everything. Everything follows logically. So maybe the universe we see, this universe in which we live, is the only way the universe could be. And that was kind of something that I think a lot of physicists sort of dreamt about. You know, wouldn't that be wonderful? It may still be the case, but within this rather larger framework of the fact that there are many universes that are all different. It's the same as saying, there's a good analogy in biology, actually. It's like perhaps physicists have been overly optimistic here. It's like saying in biology, I understand DNA. So I understand the structure of DNA, and there are four bases, A, D, C, and T, and I understand all that stuff, A, D, G, and T. Oh, no, C, that's right. My biology is rusty. So I understand the genetic code, and therefore I'll predict a human. I'll predict the existence of humans using only the genetic code alone. Now, obviously, that's not going to happen. You can't do that. Evolution has proceeded over 4 billion years. The twists and turns and random things have happened. You know, the asteroid wiped out the dinosaurs, which opened the road for the mammals to evolve into the mammals we see today, including ourselves. So you'd never be able to predict the existence of a human being from the basic building blocks of the genetic code. And it's the idea of the inflationary multiverse is really the same. So even if you have this overarching theory, each individual little pocket universe, if you like, would be like a different living organism on the planet. So they share the same basic underlying framework, the underlying laws, but you know, the idea that you predict the existence of any one of them becomes just an impossibility. And that might be the way that the world is. And if it is, then that's the thing that we're trying to understand.
Do you think, we won't use the word God, but there was something else afoot here that created all of this?
It is. I have no idea. I see no evidence of that. However, it is true that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
So that's right.
I really don't know. In the book, at the end, we speculate. It's almost a bit of fun, really. But it is true that these kind of inflationary multiverse ideas, that you just basically roll a dice every time you make a little bubble universe. And that's the way that we do simulations in particle physics, and in physics in general, actually. So we have so-called Monte Carlo programs. And almost amusingly, you can look at if this multiverse idea is right, you can look at it and say, well, if I was going to simulate different universes, this is the way that I'd do it. So we almost say, almost jokingly in the book, if you're looking for a creator, If there is evidence, it would almost be that you look out on this reality that looks like someone, some computer programmer is simulating it. It almost looks like that. Now, I'm saying that with great, with tongue in cheek, as we'd say in Britain, right? So, that is not what I think. But you can almost begin to draw that analogy as a bit of fun, essentially. And the honest answer is, we need a lot more. We have reasonable evidence for this idea of inflation, which, as I said, the distribution of galaxies. If any of your listeners know about the cosmic microwave background, this is this oldest light in the universe, the afterglow of the Big Bang, it's often described as. And there's structures in that, and the way that is distributed across the sky, that is also predicted beautifully by inflation. So we have some idea that this theory of inflation might be on the right track. But that's as far as it goes at the moment. And the multiverse thing is an addition to that. You would have to find some way of making a prediction you could test against observation for that to become a real physical theory. And we don't have that at the moment. So some people speculate we may. It may be that if you look at the oldest light in the universe or this distribution of galaxies on the sky, it becomes so compelling, our predictions become so precise that we really begin to have strong confidence in these theories. We're not there yet, though. You might have gathered, I really believe what I said earlier, which is physics is... and science in general is a humble pursuit. It's about taking small steps,
right,
and understanding what you see as best you can. And if you're led to tremendous statements about the origin of the universe, then so be it. But if you set out, and this is really important, if you set out to explain the origin of the universe, you would never have had a chance. You don't start from that. If you look at the history of astronomy and cosmology, what we set out to do was understand the motion of planets against the stars, something that everybody can do from their back garden. And then we set out to understand why the light from the stars is the way that it is, and why the light from galaxies is the way that it is. And on we go. And we end up with this understanding our universe is expanding, which suggests that it must have been smaller in the past. Then we get the evidence that it was smaller and it was hotter, and everything builds up. Then we get predictions made from that, from those ideas about a hot universe sometime in the past, about how the chemical elements, hydrogen, helium, lithium, how those things should be distributed in the universe, and they check out. And so that prediction makes sense. And on you go, and you build a picture, which then starts to talk about the earliest times in the history of the universe. But you didn't set out to do that, and I think that's very important.
It's mind-boggling, though, Brian, just trying to put the pieces together of how this was created, how it began, what nothing was. And that's another thing. What is nothing?
Well, I mean, we have two great frameworks within which we talk about the universe. One is, as I mentioned before, Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is a theory of space and time, which is extremely successful, passes every experimental test even today. You may have noticed this great measurement of gravitational waves made in the United States last year.
Yes,
which is another century-old prediction of Einstein's theory. So it's a beautiful theory. The other pillar is quantum theory, which, again, it's 100 years old. It's extremely precisely tested, and it's extremely useful. And it allows us to do things, as I said, like build transistors and lasers and all these things. So this is a very useful theory. But that really tells us there's no such thing as nothing, or at least there's no such thing as empty space.
Let's talk more about that, Brian. We're at the top of the hour. We're going to come back. We'll talk more with Brian Cox. And we'll also take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. His website's linked up at coasttocoastam.com.